Welcome to the Chamberlain's Law Firm Lawcast. The recording you're about to listen to was recorded on the 14th of June 2019 at the HIA IR and Legal Session, featuring presenters from the HIA, Chamberlain's Law Firm and Adjudicate Today. The presenters discuss the Murray Review of the SOPA and its effect on the residential building industry. If you have any questions or queries in relation to this recording, please contact Mr. Michael Terry Whittle through our website, which can be found at www.chamberlains.com.au.
Thanks everybody for coming. Thank you, Philippa and the HIA, for asking us to come along and have a chat. My name is Michael Terry Whittle. I'm the construction law partner at Chamberlain's Law Firm. We've got two speakers today. I'm one and I'm going second. The other is Bob Gosen of Adjudicate Today. He's the owner and founder of Adjudicate Today. Adjudicate Today are the largest authorised nominating authority by market share in the country. So an ANA, as we call them, they're what is the equivalent of a court when you go to adjudication. So Bob is knowledgeable about all things SOPA, or Building Construction Industry Security and Payment Act, and he's going to have a bit of a chat about what happens in terms of the residential market itself at the moment, and also some perhaps legislative changes that may be coming through as a result of the Murray Review. So the federal government commissioned a review into SOPA and its application within the industry, and it came up with 86 recommendations, some of which might be really relevant to you guys today. So Bob, why don't you take us away?
Thank you.
Pleasure.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you all for allowing me to come along today. It's a great pleasure. Last time I had to talk to a group of industry people, it wasn't the building construction industry, it was a different industry, but I was in a place some of you might have visited, Goonyella, up in central Queensland. And it was a long time travelling to get there. Anyway, I get there eventually, and a hall, not nearly as nice as this place, old place. And there's one guy sitting right up the front. And that's it. And I've travelled from Sydney, central Queensland, there's one guy sitting there. So I walk in, I give my presentation, thinking, what the hell? At the end of my presentation, I thank my audience very much. He nods at me, I nod at him, and I said, well, I'm off now, I'm going to catch the next plane back to Sydney. He gets up and says, please, no, Bob, please, Bob, no, go, don't go, please, Bob, don't go. I said, what do you mean? What, don't go. He said, no, I'm the next speaker. It's not going to happen to me today, and I thank you for that. We're a small group, so let's try and keep it informal. I'm here with John O'Brien. John's a senior adjudicator, think judge, if you like, in the private sector with Adjudicate Today. He lives here in Canberra, and it's quite possible that the disputes that you might or might not have in the future are either as claimants or as respondents come to someone like John. So both John and I are going to be hanging around, if you like, after this is all over, and more than happy to talk with you. John's a nicer guy than me, so you can ask him questions. And
that's the first thing he's got right so far this afternoon.
So let's get a little bit to hand about this. If I work out how to use this machine. Here we go. So, as Michael said, we are the largest authorised nominating authority in Australia by a long margin. To give you an idea, in last statistics we had out of the Australian Capital Territory, was we had, I think, every matter came to us. There are four or five other ADAs marketing here, but all matters came to us. In New South Wales, we have a market share of 78%, despite having six or seven competitors there. Nationally, we do over 1,000 matters a year. So we're in the game. Countries all over the world, Malaysia, Singapore, Hong Kong, Canada, consult with us in relation to these issues. So as an authorised nominating authority, been in there, done that, helped write the New South Wales legislation when I was in government back in 1993 through to 1998. So I can talk about this with some background to it. In terms of the relevance, can I just ask the question, How, obviously, we're sitting here in ACT, so you're doing work in the ACT, but how many of you are also doing work in New South Wales? Just to get some idea of how much focus I should put. Okay, so I should talk a little bit about both. Okay. So we're talking about two acts. There's a New South Wales Act and there's an ACT Act. There are some differences between them. It's not my job today to try and highlight the differences. But if you go to our website at adjudicate.com.au, you will find flowcharts there. And depending on where the work is performed, that's the basis of which piece of legislation you're going to use. So if you actually physically did the work in New South Wales, you're going to use the New South Wales Act. If you physically did the work in the ACT, you're going to use the ACT Act. Now, the sleeper in all of this is the Commonwealth, particularly in the ACT. There's no equivalent Commonwealth legislation. It's a vacuum. So in a legal sense, if the Commonwealth government is respondent, as they regularly have been respondents in the past, and I think no more than one of my favourites, which was the ASIO building, and all the complexities of security and resolving payment disputes at the ASIO building. The Commonwealth has eventually now come down with a policy, and that is, despite the fact they don't have any legal obligation to state legislation, they will abide by the state legislation where the work has been performed. So if you've done work for the Commonwealth and they haven't paid and you're looking to extract money, they will abide by the ACT legislation. They will not seek to remove themselves from the dispute. So that's important for you to know. The Commonwealth is, by their own choice, covered by that state legislation. Now, common theme amongst the acts, there are three of them. First of all, prompt payment. If I go back to my days in government, and I'm talking about when I first came to Phoenix with New South Wales in 93, 94, people from industry associations, HIA, MBA, painters, NECA, plumbers, came to then Premier Nick Ryan, and I was sitting next to him, and was saying, in terms of the forthcoming election, which was around small business themes, we want government to guarantee us to be paid. They were complaining they wouldn't be paid, and they wanted the government to guarantee they wouldn't be paid. So one of the components of the legislation is to try and put provisions for people to be paid within timeframes, a maximum timeframe. So you have to, if you make a payment claim, you've got to be paid, or if you're a recipient of a payment claim, you've got to pay within defined statutory timeframes. Now, those timeframes are different between the ACT and New South Wales, just to add a layer of confusion. So I do have a slide a little bit later on those differences. And there, you need to know about that if you're doing work. But again, if you go to the website, just go to the applicable flowchart, if you follow that, you can't go too far wrong. The second component that's common is the statutory protections. The most common reason historically for people not being paid or people not wanting to pay is they haven't been paid themselves. And the approach in Australia is pretty unique because other countries have different approaches. The UK and Canada, for example, have totally different approaches to this. But in Australia, the common exclusion is you cannot use as an excuse for non-payment that you have not been paid. In other countries, they go a different path. They say, if you haven't been paid, you can say, I'm not paying you because I haven't been paid, but you must go to adjudication within 10 business days of the date of that notification. So it's a different wheel that's being used, but has the common effect of trying to force up this issue. Now, if you're the recipient of a payment claim and you haven't been paid, well, what's the answer? Well, the simple answer is, you don't sit there and complain, and you can't argue non-payment because you haven't been paid. You make an application for payment. You use your contractual rights, the rights you have under the contract, to make payment, assuming you're not part of the exclusion for a residential, which I shall talk about shortly. And finally, the final common component is quick, effective, fair and cheap resolution of payment disputes. That's adjudication. If you want to know where that name came from, I was drunk at 3 a.m. in a minister's office trying to draft up this legislation at the last minute. And what the hell are we going to call it? We don't want to call it mediation. It's not mediation. We don't want to call it conciliation because everyone will think we're talking industrial relations and this is for small businesses and subcontractors. It's obviously not negotiation. We don't want to call it arbitration because everyone hates arbitration. If you don't hate arbitration, you need to head read. You should hate arbitration. It's the worst thing you can ever get involved in. Litigation, which is going to courts, is a much better resolution than arbitration. So we had to come up with a new name. We invented the term adjudication for my debating background. And that's history for you. So let's talk about what's excluded and what's not and understand that. Because I understand as HIA members, a lot of your work is going to come from building residential homes. And the legislation in both ACT and in New South Wales excludes in different ways the residential home owner from the provisions of the legislation. So let's talk about it for a little bit. First of all, this is all about the change, what I'm saying. I don't know if it'll be this year, it'll be next year, but I'll be talking later about the potential for change. But I might say at this early stage, you can thank HIA and some of its peer industry associations, some of the changes that are in the works at the moment. They have done a good job in terms of this area. Very good job. But let's talk about what the current situation is right now. If you are engaged by the owner of a home to do work on their home or to build a home in which they intend to reside, the acts in both New South Wales and ACT are excluded. The operation of the act doesn't apply and you have to go generally to litigation in relation to a payment dispute.
Sorry for interrupting. What about their work? Fair trading in New South Wales.
I'm going to talk about those distinctions in just a minute. Yes, you can go to fair trading in New South Wales, and that's where you would go right now.
Yeah.
But that's about to change. I'm going to talk about that.
Sure.
Give me another 5 minutes. However, in the ACT, it's different to New South Wales, this exclusion. Because here you've got something called the Construction Occupations Licensing Act 2004, in which there's a definition of a residential owner. And that definition includes a person who is a owner-builder or is a person who should hold a license as an owner-builder. And in the ACT, unlike in New South Wales, if you are registered as an owner-builder, or should be registered or licensed as an owner-builder, you are covered. So what does that mean? It means that if you're doing work in relation to a home, and that person's the owner-builder themselves, or should be the owner-builder themselves, that does apply. The exclusion clause does not apply. Just to confuse, that's not the case in New South Wales, but it is the case here. Now, what is the construction work we're talking about? Well, we're talking about work on a part, on a residential building, or a part of a residential building. Well, what does that mean? Okay, well, let me give you an example. Again, it's a little bit confusing, and it's different between the states. So you do need to maybe talk to Chamberlains about what your rights are, what your rights are not. But in ACT, let me explain the difference. If you're doing work on a garage that's underneath the house, and that garage is part of the structural integrity of the home, it's subject to the exclusion clause. But if the garage is separate from the house or attached to the house, but not part of the structural integrity of the house, the Act covers it, the work of the garage. So it's all about structural integrity, is the sort of test between the two. Again, it can be important because you want to have to be covered by the Act, or if you're not going to be covered by the Act either. If you're going into a dispute because you're worried that guys have done work for you, haven't done it properly, or you haven't been paid yourself, you really want to know what bit of law is going to be applicable. So it's worth understanding the sort of distinctions I'm trying to draw at the moment. So just to repeat, if that can be you there, Mr. and Mrs. Client, the home building contract, the subcontract, Okay. I think I've covered most of that. Now, let's go to this thing. If this is you and there's Mr. and Mrs. Client, if you're carrying out residential work within the meaning of the Building Act, the answer to that is yes. And on such part of any premises of the party where they want to live, and the answer is yes, does not apply, subject to exclusions that I mentioned a few moments ago. However, all relations between you and your tradesmen are covered. Now, that's grossly unfair if you're this guy. That's the bottom line. It's grossly unfair if you're this guy. You're the subject getting kicked by the provisions of this Act, which are meant to make it easier for people to be paid. But you can't rely on that Act to get paid yourself. And that's why you get HIA people and MBA people and other people quite passionate about this gross unfairness that's existed. By the way, that unfairness does not exist in Tasmania, it does not exist in Western Australia, and it does not exist in the Northern Territory. In those three places, everything comes under the Act. But it doesn't in ACT and it doesn't in New South Wales. Talk about the time frames, just a little bit, it's a bit of a confusing topic. Too well lit, it's a bit small, but there are big differences in time frames, as I said before. In New South Wales, if you're a principal at the moment, it's 15 business days. If you're contracting to a principal, it's 15 business days, or 30 business days up here, or 15 business days. In ACT, it's only 10 days. This 30 business days in New South Wales under amendments passed by the Parliament in November, which I helped write, are being reduced from 30 days down to 20 days. So it's worth knowing that there are different time frames between ACT and New South Wales. Again, if you're in doubt, if you fall foul of these laws and you're covered by SOPA, Security Payments Act, you can be stung. It's worth knowing and checking something perhaps with Chambers. I know that. Happy to chat you over the phone, that social type people. So, what is a payment claim? Let's just talk very briefly. I don't want to trespass what you're covering, I'm sure. But what is a payment claim? Well, it's a document in writing that identifies the construction work or the related goods and services. It indicates how much money you actually want to be paid for that and how you've calculated normally. And in the ACT, it says it must state that it's made, and using the words under the Building and Construction Industry Security Payment Act 2009, should say those words. In New South Wales, 5 years ago, they got rid of the requirement to state that a payment claim was made under the Act. We opposed it at the time, very loudly and very publicly. The result of the exclusion in New South Wales has been abject confusion between parties in that state. And in the amendments to the New South Wales Act carried by the Parliament in November, waiting proclamation at the moment, the requirement for that provision is back in. Well, they put it back in. So they took it out to put it back in again. My suggestion is, regardless of if you're in New South Wales or an ACT, put it in, because if it's in and it doesn't have to be in, it doesn't matter. Just put it in. You'll be done with it. You know, that way you won't get confused. So why is it that we have this unfairness to HIA members? That's basically how to define it. If you're an HIA member working for a homeowner, you can't use it, and everyone who works for you can use it. Well, how did that come about? Well, it all came about because when we go back to 93, 94 and framing provisions for 96, 97, the New South Wales Royal Commission of the Building Industry, there was a great fear that this wonderful new regime of legislation designed to speed up payment processes in the industry would have a backlash politically from the mums and dads homeowners. That all these obligations that were being placed on industry participants to pay within certain minimum periods of time, or else that all these penalties apply, which I'm not covering in my talk, come into play. So politicians made the decision in ACT, New South Wales, Victoria, South Australia, Queensland, to exclude the mum and dad. And that's resulted in this grand fairness. It's about to change. Now, why do I say that? Mr. Murray, John Murray, who's the chief adjudicator for Adjudicate today, took 15 months leave of absence from us and was commissioned by the Commonwealth Government to write a huge report on security of payment legislation right through Australia, or what was happening. And as Michael said, it's 86 recommendations in it. It's had fantastic coverage, got a lot of support. And one of the key recommendations is for the provisions of the legislation to apply to people across the board. I'm going to just want to read one paragraph from what John said on page 126 of his report. There seems something inherently incongruous as to how a legislative scheme that has been designed to improve the payment practices within the industry will only permit one group of contractors to avail themselves of the benefits of the legislation, and yet on the same building project, another type of contractor would be deliberately shut out of the process. True, the relationship between a residential builder and a mum and dad owner-occupier is of different nature to that of a builder and a subcontractor. But the fact remains that residential builders face similar cash flow issues to subcontractors when they do not receive prompt payment for building work carried out. So John's recommended that the Act apply equally to everybody, and thanks to the HIA's submissions and the other industry associations that made those submissions that Don was able to align. In Western Australia, we've just had a more recent report to John come out by Mr. Fiocco. Big report, recommended major changes in the West, including complete coverage legislation to the residential sector. It already applies to the residential sector over there, but in ways that make it very confusing. He wants to simplify in the same way that Murray's recommended. So that's another good thing. As I said to you before, Tasmania already had it. In New South Wales, we're sort of halfway there and playing footsies. So what's happening in New South Wales? I'm talking again about the amendments, the substantial amendments that were made to the Act in November last year. Gone through the Parliament, not yet proclaimed. Got held up with the elections. But they're waiting for proclamation. We expect them to come into play by the end of the year. What they've done, and this is confusing, a lot of people have misunderstood what they've done. They have removed the exclusion from the Act. So if you look at the Act, there is no exclusion under the amendment for you people. It's gone. But what it says is subject to what's in the regulations. And what they're doing is they're putting the exclusion into the regulations. Well, why would they do that? Well, they made the decision, talking amongst friends, they made the decision they wanted to extend it, but got such a backlash from some of the political aspects. They've gone a little bit, oh, we need more consultation. So what they've done is said, well, let's go halfway, let's put it, the exclusion of the regulation, because it's easy to get rid of, or it's easier to modify, or to fine-tune, or to do whatever they want to do, you know, as a regulation rather than amendment to the Act that has to go through the Parliament. So even though the exclusion's been removed from the Act by the amendment, it's going to be put in place by the regulation. And that's one reason why the Act hasn't been proclaimed, because that regulation hasn't yet been written, or written in such a way that they want to reveal to people. But we're halfway there, and as I said, that is a victory for HIA, industry associations generally. So that's what I wanted to talk a little bit about. Again, it's a hard issue. You should be taking advice if you haven't been paid. Should you be going to litigation, or can you make use of the Act because you come under one of the exclusions, or don't come under one of the exclusions? Which state you're in, it's all different. The last thing you want to do is to make an application for adjudication and find that it's invalid. And you lose all the time and you lose your money and everything else. It's simple, just to get a bit of advice quickly. Please, if you take one thing away from what I'm saying to you today, don't talk to your mate on the suburban back door. They don't understand this Act. We have the greatest problems in the 1,000-odd matters we do a year. The biggest single problems we have is legal advice being given by people who are solicitors who have not the foggiest inclination about this legislation and its peculiarities. so that the people fall over. If you're going to get involved in one of these disputes, either as a respondent or as a claimant, go to somebody who understands the Act and specialises in the Act. Please, don't go to a footman if you've got a problem with the brain. Go to someone who understands it, and you'll be a lot better off. That's it. Any questions? No? I covered what you wanted? Yes?
Just on that last slide when you were going through the recommendations that are coming up, that doesn't mention ACT. Is that going to flow into the ACT legislation?
The easy answer is probably. The ACT has a long and distinguished history of watching what New South Wales does, watches it for a couple of years, and then quietly follows on, often in a way that's better than what New South Wales has done it, in fairness to them. They're always towards the rear of the pack, but when they do it, they normally do it. Yeah. So there's no reason to believe that they won't follow on. The other thing that I didn't mention is Murray has recommended there be federal legislation. If there's federal legislation, there'll be one act for all of Australia. We won't have to worry about all these state differentials. There's an exclusion that I won't go into it now. But there'll be one act, and that one act will include under direct recommendations full coverage in the residential sector. Now, Labor gave an undertaking to implement that within 12 months of the election. They haven't been elected. The Libs are there. The Libs aren't opposed to it, but they're not doing anything either. So it's a bit of a question as to what they do with that Murray recommendation. Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
Can I ask you to get mine up there for me? Thanks, Bob. And one thing I will say is, if you're not familiar with adjudication in general, Adjudicate Today's website, I'm not saying this because I'm affiliated with them, it has a mass of material that's written in plain language that can sort of explain it. So if you're not too familiar with it, if you throw Adjudicate into Google, they're probably going to be the first ones that come up. If you play around on their website, that's probably the first step, and obviously it's free. If my colleague here, Dan, can work the technology. Excellent. Thank you, sir. So I've titled my talk today, How to Protect Yourself from the Greedy Subby. It seemed catchier than How to Prepare a Payment Schedule under the Building Construction Industry Security and Payment Act. Now, as Bob mentioned, this seemed relevant to talk to you guys today about, because assuming you probably sit in that unfairness zone where Bob's talked about, where you're not claiming against your homeowners but you're still liable against your subbies, it's got some direct relevance. I'm pretty fond of analogies. So if Security and Payment Act is the party and you find yourself in that spot, you're the designated driver, and you've still got the cleanup to go with it. One thing I will say is, and you probably picked it up from what Bob said, the legislation is really, really complicated and complex, and the court decisions which came down under it often conflicted with each other, which makes it even more confusing. When I give these types of talks, what I prefer to do is try and give you not the technical side of things, I don't want to put you to sleep citing sections and cases and etc., but give you something sort of practical that you can hopefully take away and actually use in your business. With that said, if you do have any questions or you're more interested in the technical side, you can shout them out or come and see us afterwards. Bob, John and I are always happy to have a beer and a chat about the finer intricacies of SOPA. Otherwise, I'll try and keep it fairly light. So, what is SOPA? Bob's already gone over this pretty comprehensively. In my own words, it's an alternative to going to court. It's designed to get people who work in the construction industry paid, and get them paid quickly. Now, when I say quickly, to give you an idea, from the start to finish, and it's all on the papers, so there's no face-to-face, there's no court appearance, from issuing a payment claim, which is typically just an invoice, to getting your decision, which is also writing, that process, start to finish, 7 weeks at its longest, roughly. To put that into context, come to a lawyer with the same dispute and say, I want to head off to the ACT Magistrates Court, you're looking at about 8 to 18 months. So it's substantially quicker. And in the sacrifice to give you speed, it's absolutely brutal in its application. When you condense a process that is 8 to 18 months long into 7 weeks, what they do is they create a step-by-step process. If you miss a step, if you miss a time frame, forget about it. There's no second bites at the cherry. You've lost your rights or you've exposed yourself to liability, which is what we're here to talk about today, because if you miss a step when someone has given you a payment claim, you're going to be in all sorts of trouble. But fortunately, not missing the steps and getting it done right really isn't that difficult. When does it apply? So it's all well and good for me to stand up here and tell you it's always going to apply to you, but I'd like to try and give you something to take away so you can use. If you get a request for payment from a subby, you can understand yourself and make your own judgment call. And as I mentioned, I'm fond of analogies. So to use an analogy, if you wanted to play a game of park footy, and you're down there on a Saturday, presuming you paid your regio fees, of course, before you're allowed on the field, you're going to need your boots, your jersey, and your mouthguard. If you've got those three things, you're on the field. Once you're on the field, the rules are going to apply to you, and they're going to apply to you the same, whether you're the best or the worst player, first game or last game. Taking that through here, boots, jersey, mouthguard, it's got to be for construction work or related goods or services. There are a couple of exclusions, so mining is out, and as we talked about, if you're working directly for a homeowner, you're out. But really, in terms of what you guys are dealing with, it's everybody who's not an employee that you pay to assist you to deliver a project. So if you go and ask an architect to draw up some plans, they're probably going to be covered. Ask Boral to deliver you guys some sand, they're going to be covered. Grab in a waterproofing subby to do your bathrooms, they're going to be covered. The next step is that it has to be under a contract or other arrangement. Don't need to talk to contracts. I'm sure you guys are using the fabulous contracts put out by HIA already. You know when you've entered into a contract. These words that appear in the legislation, other arrangement, designed to capture pretty much everything else. So if I ring Bob and say, Bob, I need you and two blokes to come and lay some bricks for me at my job in Fishwick, I'll give you $50 an hour. If that's all done on the telephone, that's going to get captured because it's an other arrangement. And the last step is they have to file the application or issue their payment claim under the legislation that applies to the territory or state where the work is being performed. So that's a pretty low bar. And so the short version is it will always apply to you. But yeah, jersey, mouthguard, boots is the analogy I try to use. What could go wrong? Short version, heaps. So the Act is quite draconian. You have 10 business days to issue your payment schedule once you get a payment claim. And a payment claim is in writing, and it's a request for payment, as Bob took you through. Again, in terms of the bar that that's got to be, it's got to be pretty much state the words if it's in the ACT, describe the work, and indicate the amount for payment. Any invoice you receive, it's got the magic words for ACT, and it doesn't need those if it's New South Wales, probably going to be a payment claim. When that happens, you've got 10 business days. If you don't provide a payment schedule within 10 business days, a couple of fun things happen. So the first is, the Act says you've immediately admitted everything your subby has invoiced you for. And what can they do then? They can shoot themselves off to court, and you're not allowed to defend yourself. So what the legislation says is not only have you accepted whatever the invoice says, but if they sue you for it in court, you can't raise any defence under the contract. To break down what under the contract means, it's anything to do with time, cost or quality. So your subby has delayed the job, doesn't matter. Your subby has charged you rates which are exorbitant and not what you agreed, doesn't matter. Your subby's work is defective, doesn't matter. Now, that's if they decide to sue you straight away. They might decide to go to adjudication because it's 7 weeks and quick and cheaper and easier. They'll issue you a notice under the Act. If you don't respond to that notice, same thing. When you get to adjudication, you can't defend yourself. So you can't write that the subby was late, the job was delayed or overcharged. And as you'd imagine, when someone tries to sue you or goes to adjudication against you and you're not entitled to defend yourself, they're going to win pretty often. Now, I wrote in the most recent article, I think, for HIA, I gave an example how this would work with, I think, a brickie who was going to do work for $50 an hour but was going to charge $100 an hour and would have got paid. Not sure if you saw that. What I'm going to do is I'm going to take an absurd example. I'm going to run it through this process just to try and ram this point home before we get on to how we actually deal with it. So before I do this, is anybody here a floor install or supply contractor? Good. Before I make someone a villain, always an important question to ask. Who's a builder? Anybody? What's your name, mate?
Rodney.
Rodney. Perfect. So Rodney is building a house in Watson, and the client has selected some wooden floors, bamboo floating floorboards, and he engages Jim, the flooring supply contractor, to install the floors for 20 grand. Happy days. Gets to a Friday afternoon, it's 2:30, Jim decides he's in a hurry to get to the pub, doesn't really want to do the cleanup that he usually would do, so he trots himself out the backyard, grabs the garden hose, comes in and washes down the floors. Doesn't take a genius to figure out what's going to happen to these wooden floorboards. I know this is absurd, deliberately so. Obviously, to use the polite word, they're stuffed. Rodney's not on site to see this, obviously. Rodney shows up on Monday, has a look, and instead of floating floors, he's got aqua floors. And he rings up Jim, says, Jim, you're an idiot. You can't use a hose on wooden floors. The job is stuffed. This is going to cost me a fortune. I'm going to have to replace it. My client's going to go nuts. I'm going to be coming after you for every cent. Here's the rub. A payment schedule has to be in writing. That's not one. Now, Rodney, for the next 2 weeks or 10 business days, he's dealing with his crazy client who's now fuming. He's trying to reorganise his other trades who can't come in to do their works. He's got to go and find a different flooring installer who's not Jim. To replace the works, Jim sends his invoice in. Rodney doesn't respond. What happens next? Well, the floors are stuffed, but as I just said, you can't say that because you haven't issued a payment schedule. Jim takes himself off to court. He's going to win because you can't say he completely stuffed the job because he ran a hose over wooden floorboards. You can't say it's going to cost me an absolute fortune to replace this work. My job is now delayed. I've got liquidated damages. You can't say any of that. You're going to go to court. Jim's going to win. Now, under this act, because it's so brutal, it's interim, which means you can sue them later under general law to get your money back. But if you run your head through what that process would look like, Rodney has now paid 20 grand to Jim, because he's won in court. He's got his angry client, he's got to replace the works for that 40 grand. And then he's going to come and see someone like me and say, Jim's done this, let's sue. And I'm going to say, you've got a cracking case here. Guy's an idiot. But that's going to take 8 to 18 months and about 40 grand in legal fees. Now, Rodney, you're probably going to win in that situation, but for the next 18 months, you're 100 grand in the red. Taking the same process and applying it to adjudication, only this time Jim issued a notice. Rodney's still very busy dealing with his client and everybody else, doesn't respond. Exact same outcome. I think I've done this to death, but when I say that this stuff's important, I sometimes get clients who tell me, no, it's not. And when they say no, it's not, it's usually a variation on one or two statements. The first is, Michael, it's not important because I always use the same subbies, I've used them forever and I trust them and I've never had an issue. Or the other statement I get is, Michael, I've been in the game forever and I've never needed a lawyer. And my response to both of those sort of positions is, it's the equivalent of saying, Michael, I've never been in a car accident, I don't need to put on a seatbelt. Yeah, sure you do. If you drive a car for long enough, you're probably going to be in an accident. If you are in construction for long enough, going to have a dispute about payment. Fortunately, putting on a seatbelt is not that hard.
Sorry, question. What if,
please.
Jim issued an invoice to start with that wasn't under the Security Payments Act.
Yep.
And then 6 months later, his mate said, geez, you should issue that under the Security Payments Act.
Sure.
For like paying.
Yep.
What happens then?
Yep, so that gets a bit tricky, and we're going to go through how we do that. But the short version is, it has to do with reference dates, which is going to be on a checklist that you guys have got that I'm going to talk us through on how to do it. But a reference date is the date under your contract, if your contract says it. So if it says 25th of the month, you can invoice. Or if it says at the end of excavation, you can invoice. It's the date when someone's invoice would become a payment claim. If the contract doesn't say anything, it's the last day of the month. So if I don't have a contract with you, Rodney, and I've got you to come and lay some bricks for me, if you did the work in June, it will become a payment claim on the 30th of June or afterwards when you serve it on me. If you give me your invoice on the 28th of June, it's an invoice. I don't have to worry about any of this. I can just ignore it. If you give it to me on the 30th of June or for the 12 months after the 30th of June, it's a payment claim and this will apply. Which is why you've got to be really, really careful because it gets, there's a whole bunch, as I mentioned, it's a bit complex. And the best case scenario or best practice is to treat every claim for payment as a payment claim, and then you run through the checklist and you go through and you tick all your boxes, and then you can never get caught. Because even in the absurd example I gave, where you're absolutely going to be right, you know, by the time you run that through the courts, you can get restitution. So the Act says that if you paid someone under the Act, you can get your money back for what you paid them, plus you can get your damages. But who wants to carry that for 18 months, you know? On a simple example, as you guys know, defects claims, etc., if you've got to cash flow them, they can get really expensive really quickly. And if you've got that, plus legal fees occurring on an ongoing monthly basis for the next 18 months, how that will hit your guys' cash flow and ability to take more jobs on, put more people on, is pretty significant. So preparing your payment schedule. Before I get to the checklist, I'm going to just run through what a payment schedule has to do, and then also one last word of warning. I don't mean to be a doomsday crier standing up here, but your payment schedule, what does a payment schedule need to do? Same boots, mouthguard, jersey analogy. It's got to refer to the payment claim, which is the invoice. It's got to tell them how much you're planning to pay. And if you're not planning to pay all of the invoice, it's got to tell them the reasons why not. Now, a couple of things here. That's a really low bar. So you've got to be really careful if you get an outrageous claim, not to just snap back. Sorry, it also has to be in writing. Not just snap back with an email that says, you're a goose. I'm not paying any of this, because that may fall into a payment schedule. I recently ran a case and I assisted a client to prepare a very large payment claim. It was $1.7 million on this job. We sent that through. It was about a 40-page submission that went through this thing. The job was rubbish and we had to reconstruct it. An hour and a half after the email goes, the bloke writes back and he says, "Hi, X, I got your invoice. I'm shocked. Get stuffed. We don't owe you a cent." And we ran that through the process, and that was upheld as being a payment schedule. So if you do get a claim, always take a day, just sort of some deep breaths and what have you, and go through the process pretty quickly. Just be careful with your emails. So in the materials that you got that are in those packs that Dan has fabulously put together, there'll be a checklist that looks something like this. It's got 15 items on it. If you look down at that checklist, or if you're looking up at it here and you're thinking to yourself, Michael, that looks like a lot of work, you're wrong. It's really not. If you add this, this deals with a couple of technical issues, but otherwise, it's just a process to go through and make sure you don't skip anything that you will already know. If you've got a difficult subbie, same way if you've got a difficult homeowner who's causing guys issues, you're going to know that they're there, and you're going to know what the issues were in the job. They usually aren't just springing up out of the blue. If you're running your jobs well, this is just a way to go through it to make sure that for compliance with this complex legislation purposes, you're always okay. The next thing I'll say just before I start here is both the New South Wales and the ACT Act have one more curveball to throw at you, some of the unfairness that Bob was talking to, which is if you, in a payment schedule, don't give a reason for why you're withholding payment, you can't use it later. So the process is, you get a payment claim, that's the invoice, payment schedule, that's you telling them how much you're going to pay them. And then if they still don't like it, as Bob said, they're going to go and take themselves off to adjudicate today. They're going to lodge their adjudication application, which is an application in writing. And then you can prepare an adjudication response, which is basically your court case all happening in written form, where you can write all and provide all of your evidence back as to why you're right not to be paying them. And then you're going to get a decision. That second stage, if you haven't in your payment schedule used a reason, it can't be used then. So you could go to the best security of payment lawyer who's ever lived, who's got a whole bag of tricks, after you've got an adjudication application, and he might have the world's best arguments that mean you would absolutely win. And he won't be able to use them if you haven't at least referred to them in a payment schedule, which is why we go through the entirety of the list.
Can you talk about costs associated with that in terms of getting costs back?
Sure. So in terms of legal fees for adjudication, you can't claim those back. So if you come and see, for example, me and I assist you to prepare your payment claim or I assist you to prepare a payment schedule, whatever you spend on the lawyer will not be recoverable. The adjudicator will charge a fee. The ANA can charge a fee. Adjudicate today don't. But the adjudicator will charge their fee, and the way the process works is adjudicators today have got some fixed fee options, so that if it's if you're dealing with a small amount, say $5,000 that you were chasing or somebody's chasing you for, it'll be less. It's not just like lawyers where we start a clock and make a cup of coffee. I'm kidding. Get these large amounts. But what happens is the adjudicator, once he's finished his decision, adjudicate today will write to the parties and say, our decision's available now. Can you pay our invoice? And once you've paid the invoice, you get the decision. The adjudicator, once he's decided who has won, can decide who has to pay his fees. So if you are the claimant and the adjudicator's fees were $1,000 and you've paid those so that they come out and you win, then that might get added to the money the respondent owed you. If you're the respondent and you're successful, you might not have to pay anything. In terms of putting that into context, and I'll speak from my own practice because I do this quite a lot. If I do an adjudication application, a straightforward, pretty simple adjudication application, typical legal fees on that will be anywhere from, say, $3,000 to $8,000. If it is really, really simple, it might be $500 where I tell you, this is so easy, I'm just going to talk you through the process, cast my eye over what you've done at the end to make sure it ticks all the boxes and away you go. This is to prepare a claim. The same claim, any claim in the Magistrates Court, if you're going to run a building claim in the Magistrates Court here in the ACT, you are starting at $30,000 and you are moving your way up. A typical matter over those 8 to 18 months, inclusive of legal and expert fees, is $30,000 to $50,000. The most expensive adjudication application I have personally ever prepared cost $72,000. It was for $3.4 million, and we had volumes upon volumes of materials. We took up an entire boardroom. We had five people working on it day and night for a fortnight. So in terms of the costs, while you can get those back when you sue someone, if you win, the cost that you lose in terms of going through adjudication, it's a lot quicker and it's a lot cheaper. Obviously, you make a commercial decision on the basis of each matter you go through, and you just make an informed decision on that. So any other questions before we jump onto this? Okay, this is a pretty simple system. When I say you need to refer to a reason in your payment schedule, you do not need to go chapter and verse. That can all happen later at the adjudication response. As long as you refer to something in the payment schedule, then it's going to count. So your payment schedule can be an email, by the way. I'm not paying you because... dot point, dot point, dot point, dot point, dot point. And then attached is an Excel spreadsheet showing, where I've decided to cut your claim down because you claim this variation, which I don't agree with. I do agree with this sum, etc. So has it been submitted with a valid reference date? As I mentioned, that's the date that your contract says they can claim against you. If you don't have a contract with them or a purchase order or something like that, it's the last day of the month. Now, it's on or after. So that means for work from the 5th of June, I can claim that from you guys here if I've done it on the 28th of August, if that's when I get around to invoicing, and that's okay. However, if you've instructed someone to do a concrete pour for you last week, and they send you an invoice tomorrow, that's an invoice because their date hasn't arisen yet. It'd be the last day of this month. The next one is, has it been made under a contract or other arrangement? This tends to come up where you're using the same sub in multiple jobs. And it can get a bit confusing and it'll be complex depending upon what site you're working on. So let's say, for example, you're doing a job in Gungahlin, Watson and Bell Common, thank you, sir. And you're using a concrete pump. So you're getting a line pump in, and they come and they do all three jobs, and then they hit you with an invoice for all three jobs. You've got to make a decision. Did you have one contract with them for one job separately, or did you have one contract with them which says they're going to come around and just pump concrete wherever you pick up the phone and you call? If they've got multiple, what this says is that they can only issue one per contract. They can also only issue one per reference date. So if you're getting multiple invoices, this is where that'll come in. If somebody grabs three invoices and puts them all together in one email and sends them to you, one payment claim. If someone sends you an invoice on Monday, an invoice on Wednesday, an invoice on Friday, then they might be three separate claims and the last two aren't going to work. That can be a bit complicated. If anybody wants to ask me a question at the end about this process, I'm happy to chat through it. Next one is an attention to detail thing, but you'd be surprised how often it comes up. Whose name is on the invoice to you? In construction, you can get complex structures. So you can have, you know, Jim's scaffolding, Jim's PTY Ltd, Jim's group, PTY Ltd, Jim's scaffolding enterprises, PTY Ltd. Who has actually invoiced you? If they're not the right person, maybe you don't have a contract and you don't have an arrangement with them. The next one is the exact opposite. Hopefully you guys have all had some corporate structuring advice at some point from your accountant and then your lawyer. Don't just take it from the accountant. You might have set up your company to minimise risk. So you might be holding all of your, you know, your utes and your tools, etc., in one particular company, doing some trading in another company, and have a company that sits above the top that gobbles up all the money and splits it out through a family trust or however complicated it gets. Make sure that when they're invoicing you, that they've invoiced the correct company that you've traded with them for. Next is, have they sufficiently identified the work? If I send Rodney, sorry to pick on you, Rodney, if I send Rodney an invoice that says all work and variations at 12 Kerford Street, Watson, $12,213, what does that mean? How is that describing the work? If it's not, then it's not valid. Now, just to be clear on that one, the test, don't get cute with it, okay? The test is what you, being the person running the job, would know from the email. So while that might mean, that email might mean absolutely nothing to me as I stand here, I'd say, what bloody work, no idea what trade you are. If Rodney is sitting there and goes, I know exactly what this is, then it probably is valid. But if it's not clear, and if you don't understand exactly what work they're trying to charge you for, then you should say it's not sufficiently described and then tell them that as the reason. Does it indicate an amount for payment? This one will almost never come up. I mean, you're going to get invoices. The only reason it's there on the checklist is if you get a request for payment to consider whether or not it's a payment claim. Well, I say to Rodney, mate, you still haven't paid me for the work I've done back in March. The boys are chasing me. If you remember, it was four blokes at 5 hours. Can you fix that up? You might start saying, all right, is that a payment claim? If it doesn't indicate an amount for payment, the answer is no. And you can tick that box. By the way, I should pause there and say, if you're deciding it's not a payment claim, don't just decide that yourself. You have to tell them in the payment schedule. Yeah, so don't just form the view, I don't need to worry about this. Better safe than sorry, you can just shoot them an email.
Can I just add that?
Sure.
Don't forget to include GST if GST is applicable.
Yeah.
Because an adjudicator cannot add GST for you later. You can't, he or she as the adjudicator cannot award more than you've asked for. So always include GST.
Yep, if you're claiming. All right, so that's the technical component of this checklist, and I appreciate that might be new and it can get a little bit complicated. The balance of the checklist is going to be really easy, so I'm just going to run through it again. That's the date that they can claim from you under your contract, which means the Act is going to apply. This is double checking that they haven't invoiced you across multiple jobs or tried to bulk up together a whole bunch of work and claim from you. Who's invoicing you? Are they invoicing you correctly? Have they described the work? And are they requesting an amount for payment? The balance from here on in is all stuff you guys know, but it's just a process to make sure that you will capture it comprehensively. Have you told them before why you're not going to pay them? Let's go back to Jim and his aqua boards. If we have written an email to Jim straight after that happens on Monday, Rodney, rather than call him, sends him an email and goes, mate, you have killed me here. The entire job is stuffed. This is going to cost me a fortune. If we've said anything of that nature, we should be referring to it in the payment schedule. You won't need to go and dig that out. Okay, so you're not going to have to go back and say it was 2 April and I sent this email and here's a copy. Do that if you like. But you can say, as I've already told you by email, you've stuffed the job. It's completely defective. That's going to be enough, because then if he does go to adjudication, as I mentioned, you can now use that reason. If you're not saying it, you can't. The next, which should be 8, says, have they complied with the terms of their contract? So this is pretty simple. Have they issued the claim on the right date? Have they, you know, if there's a variation or what have you, did they have to give you notice before they claimed it? Did they? Could they only do a variation if they had a signed day docket and they don't have one? That's some stuff that you'll know. The next is, are they contractually entitled to what they claim? So have they claimed stages 1, 2 and 3 but only finished stage 1? Okay, have they claimed that they've done 80% of the work when really they've only been on site for a week on a 6-week job? Next is, do you have a right of set-off? So are they subject to a retention? Have they allowed for that retention? Are you able to set off a future cost? So they've tried to charge you for materials they're bringing to site, but you haven't agreed to pay them yet for the materials until, you know, until the glass is actually in the windows. That's when they can charge you. Have they tried to charge you for just delivering the glass to site or ordering the glass? And the big one, is the work defective? Now, if the work is defective, you've got to do two things. If you remember nothing else, do this one. You've got to give an idea about what the value of the cost of the defects is. Well, you've got to do something better than just state that the work is defective. Now, that doesn't mean rush off to Tyrrells and get a report. If you've got a couple of photos from on site, that'll do. If you've got a vague idea, which you guys probably will have, being in the game of how much stuff will cost to fix, tell them that. Okay, I've got, you know, you've buggered the floors, it's going to cost me 20 grand just to rip it up. 2 days later, clean up, and then I'm going to have to reinstall it, probably 40 grand at this stage, and you're liable for a lot. Last one is there any other reason that I haven't already captured? That's just a catch-all in case something brilliant occurs to you at 9 p.m. when you're doing your invoicing and dealing with subbies payments, in case you missed anything on the list. This is an example. So, Frank, you claim work for 2 jobs. Okay, so that was reason number 2. You need to give me 2 separate invoices. Okay, your invoice has gone to the wrong group. Okay, this is, you've set, got me at this company instead of John Construction Services. Please reissue it. So that's it, reason number 4. As per my email of 1 June, so this is reason number 7. Obviously, Frank was doing some painting. You didn't put down any drop sheets, and you painted the kitchen ceiling. Now the joinery and the bench top and the floor is buggered. I'll need to fix that up. I'm going to try fixing it just by cleaning first. And that's going to be 3 days' labour. My labours are a bit slow. But if a clean and polish won't fix it, we could have a big problem, and I might need to replace the works. Presumably with that, you give a photo, which I haven't put in this example. Last one is, you haven't allowed for retentions, which I think is reason number 8, which wasn't numbered. So you've claimed, you know, 10 grand, but I'm entitled to deduct 10%, so I could only give you 9 in any event. Please see the attached assessment, and that's your Excel spreadsheet, or however it is that you formally communicate. If you're not using an Excel spreadsheet, you should. Guys, that brings me to an end, which I'm sure everyone's glad with. Happy to take some questions. I'm also happy to throw it open to the 2 esteemed gentlemen to my left, who are knowledgeable in all things SOPA. But yeah, does anybody have any questions? Yep.
So you mentioned set off in that.
Yes.
Can set off be used for retention if retention's not in the contract?
No. You've got to impose a contractual obligation for them to give you retention. You should. It should go into every contract. From time to time, I get clients and they're like, my subbies will never accept that. I said, fine, put it in your contract and then agree not to charge it. If it's in there, then you can use it. Yeah. Any others?
Sorry, can I just ask, it's a bit vague, but
sure.
If you have damages on a site and you, you know by the schedule that a particular trade was in, and then you come back and the thing was damaged but you can't prove it, and you ask them, did you damage it, and they say no.
I know that.
What would your recommendation be?
Okay, hypothetically and broadly, I want to make it clear I can't give legal advice at the moment. One, without a retainer agreement. Two, I wouldn't shout it out in front of living people. Questions of evidence are always difficult. They are also very difficult at adjudication. As you can imagine, I can put people into a witness box in a courtroom where everyone can see them, ask them all sorts of questions, and, you know, if they're a liar, I'll hopefully expose them if I'm good at my job. If you're going to adjudication, it's all on the paper, so it becomes even harder. If you're dealing with that sort of issue in the face of a claim for payment, you should absolutely allege it, and then you've just got to do the best that you can. So things like site diaries, things like stat decks from your project manager who says, I left site and Dan was there Monday 11, I got back to site at 3 p.m, Dan was still there, he was the only trade, and at 5 p.m. I noticed that, things of that nature. You've just got to do the best you can. If it's damage to adjoining property, your public liability insurer should possibly step in. So if it's not necessarily damage on your site, if it's damage within your site but to works that you're not meant to be doing, or you're doing the granite flat and someone runs the excavator through the lounge room wall, perhaps that's also covered. That's a question for, you know, your insurance broker or your insurance lawyer. Yeah, that's how I deal with that. Yep.
A bit of a flip.
Sure.
You've been contacted by the client who's not very happy with the job, of defects, and they want to actually get out of the contract.
Yes.
What's your advice to me?
Aha. Again, I'm going to speak very much hypothetically. Those situations turn on their own facts. Depends upon which contract you're using. If you're using the HIA contract, which I'm passingly familiar with, there is a process there. The legal concept is substantial breach. And the HIA contracts, if you're not using them, you should. They're very, very helpful in the sense that anything a client does to you in terms of non-payment, etc., is defined as a substantial breach. But what you do to the client, funnily enough, isn't. So it's a much harder burden for them to get to. If you are demonstrating a willingness to go back and fix the work, then they are not entitled to terminate. If they do try and terminate you, if they just say, this is all stuff, you've got to come back to fix it, and you say, look, it's not my responsibility, or indeed, it's not stuffed, then you've got a dispute. Say that, but also say, but of course I'm willing to fix whatever I'm required to fix. Always let them know you're still going to fulfil your contractual obligations, even though you might disagree with them what your contractual obligations are. They might be asking for a swimming pool when you agreed to build them a back deck, for example. Say, look, I don't think that I was meant to do that. I'm happy to meet with you and discuss, but I'm always willing to fulfil my contract. Then they can't terminate on you. Because there is, or depending upon the terms of your contract.
And if you disagree with some of the stuff that they've defined for payment defects, what do you actually do then? What recourse do you have?
You've got a couple of different options. If it's within New South Wales, you can engage Fair Trade. They will come out, they will conduct basically a conciliation conference. They don't typically resolve technical disputes. They get out there and say, come on guys, let's all get along. So when everyone says, we're not getting along, they say, well, this is a bit difficult, we're going to walk out. And at that point, it will depend upon your specific circumstances. There's a variety of strategies that you would then employ, but it's really difficult for me to tell you unless I know all of those. So a couple of those would be, you would come to an agreement and document it with respect to defect sale compromise. That's not mine, that is, I'll fix this. But because that one's not, I'll fix it anyway, but it's a variation. That's if you want to keep doing the work. Perhaps if you didn't want to do the work, you'd simply dig your heels in the sand, issue a demand for payment, which they won't pay, which would be a substantial breach, hit them within the show cause notice. There's a variety of...
Assuming they're paid, and this is after the event, do I get in touch with the model, for example?
No. You can absolutely always get in touch with Bob. He loves phone calls, particularly late at night. unfortunately, adjudication isn't going to assist in that space. And with respect to their complaints, you can try and get them to see sense. Otherwise, you can pretty much invite them to sue, which is not a pleasant spectre, but unfortunately, they're the two sort of options. Either compromise and get a deal, or somebody sues you. Yeah. All right, guys, thanks very much.
Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed the podcast. As with all Chamberlain's Law Firm podcasts, the information that you have heard in this podcast is not legal advice and cannot be considered legal advice. If you have any questions or queries, please do not hesitate to contact our office on 02 6188 3600 or otherwise look us up on our website, which is www.chamberlains.com.au.